Call the Conference Committee on House File 2151 to order. First of all, why don't we get started by, I'll just kind of lay out a quick roadmap. As everybody knows, we're under a little time pressure, and we're going to just go through a side-by-side with Research Council, just to quickly touch on the things. And I would propose that we then hone in on probably the three areas that are the toughest, most controversial. The others are quite similar, and I'd like to, if we could work on those three right away and come to a decision, and then just wrap up with the other items of less controversy, and hopefully finish this conference committee up before the Timberwolves game's over. So, so with that, why don't I ask House Counsel to? We want to walk through a side by side. Bob and John can help out on Senate areas that are in question. If there's a question.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just try to highlight the differences in the two versions succinctly here. Beginning with the first issue, requiring immediate credit for incorrect directory assistance. In the House, that's required of any person providing directory assistance, whereas the Senate language requires that only of a local exchange carrier providing directory assistance. The Senate also requires a customer to notify of his or her right to an immediate credit, and there's no comparable provision in the House language. The second issue concerns requiring approval from wireless customers for a substantive contract change. The House language requires providers to give 30 days' notice of a substantive contract change that's initiated by the provider. The Senate language requires 60 days' notice. The House also specifies how a customer must be notified of a provider-initiated substantive change in a contract. The House has no comparable provision. In the House, a provider-initiated substantive contract change becomes effective unless the customer opts out, which the customer can do affirmatively in writing and terminate the contract within the 30-day notice period. There's different language in the Senate. It specifies that a provider-initiated substantive change becomes effective only if the customer affirmatively opts in writing within the 60-day notice period. Finally, the Senate also includes a provision that specifies that a provider must clearly disclose to the customer any contract changes that are initiated by the customer, and the company is required to maintain verification of the disclosure. There's no comparable provision in the House language. With respect to regulating expanded calling areas, the House language pertains only to independent telephone companies with fewer than 50,000 subscribers, whereas the Senate language pertains to all telephone companies. The Senate also requires that prices, terms, and conditions in agreements to terminate expanded calling traffic be publicly disclosed, and it allows other carriers to adopt those prices, terms, and conditions for similar services provided in those exchanges, and there's no comparable provision in the House language. Turning to page two, we next have three or four provisions that are included in the Senate language but are not in the House. The first speaks to reducing rate regulation for certain business customers. It states which customers that applies to, what geographic areas it applies to, and establishes criteria for what are called competitive areas that the Public Utilities Commission will determine that those that reduced rate regulation can also apply to. Yeah, this Article 7 in the Senate also gives the Public Utilities Commission additional responsibilities, first to, in conjunction with the Office of the Attorney General and the Department of Commerce, to develop a process to resolve complaints of consumers seeking monetary reimbursements, and it also requires the Commission to recommend a plan to the legislature to expand and reduce the cost of plans offering flat-rate statewide calling. Article 3 in the Senate repeals obsolete rules relating to telephone equipment. There's no comparable provision in the House. Article 4 of the Senate modifies regulations governing local granting of cable service franchises. That allows more favorable terms for additional franchise regarding service area and public and educational and governmental access requirements. There's no comparable provision in the House. And finally, in the House, has two issues, one prohibiting third-party billing and another modifying alternative regulation plans for telephone companies. These were both passed in both houses in Senate File 1115, but they're still in the House version, and they're not in the Senate version. Mr. Chair, that concludes my discussion of the differences.
All right, thank you, Mr. Eloff. Mr. Fuller, any comments you have on any of the issues?
Not really. There are the two that are identical, the deposits and the cable re-ray. And I think
those are the two identical articles.
Right. Okay. And then in the wireless consumer protection, I think it's important to note that the definition of substantive change is, or substantive change is quite different, because we include something that changes the duration of the contract, which has been a source of complaints from consumers. They'll make a minor change, but it kicks out their contract for a period of time, and they don't know that. So you don't have that in the House file. We have it in the Senate file.
Okay. Okay. On that note, I think that might, of the three provisions, I think Senator Kelly and I have talked as well, and what he suggested, and I agree, is let's look at the three areas that I think most agree are the most different or controversial. One is the cell phone language. The second is, the cable competition Article 4 provision. And the third is the deregulation part, Article, I believe it's 7 now.
That's correct. Yeah.
7 in the House bill, yeah. Senate bill?
Yeah.
Article 7.
Is Ray?
Ray's not here. Representative Vanderveer had a significant interest in the cell phone subject, and I asked Page to get him so he could sit in on the discussion, and until he comes, maybe we should, Senator Kelly, would you want to... should we start with the deregulation part or the cable part?
Mr. Chairman, we can certainly do that.
Why don't we start with the cable provision? That would be my intention to allow some minor testimony, just some very brief testimony. Senator Kelly, do you have any thoughts on that? I don't want to open this up for a full-fledged committee hearing, but I would understand there might be some people that have an interest, but something.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, my understanding is that the bill was heard in the House, though it did not end up coming out of committee, and that it was also heard in the Senate. So I don't know that I agree with you. I don't think we need full testimony, but obviously it there was a motion to remove it in the Senate that did not prevail, and so I think what we should probably get is sort of an update on where proponents or opponents think we ought to go from here with respect to how the conference committee ought to approach the issue.
Okay. It sounds like a plan. Why don't we just folks, we're going to keep this limited. I would say maybe Mr. Knickerbocker, is he here? Or Mike Ahern?
Jerry's here.
Would one of you want to, or is there somebody else? But I would say let's start with one proponent, one opponent, and leave it at that. So you know who you are here. Pick somebody that can make your case in 30 seconds or less. Okay, a minute and a half.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Senator Anderson.
I think it's pretty clear who the sort of main proponents and opponents are, but I think some issues have arisen in the last, well, in the recent weeks from some of the big cities, the larger cities at least. I don't know if the smaller cities as well, but I know my city and Minneapolis have raised some significant issues, and I wonder if they may be coming from a third direction. I wondered if they could have 30 seconds. Or
yeah, that would work. Let's try to keep it to a couple minutes.
Sure,
I mean,
absolutely.
Just give us a status of where you think things are at. I think on the left end we've got microphones. If
Mr. Chairman, you know, may I recommend that the witnesses come to the,
why don't we,
to the table here? With
why don't we have them all come together?
Frankly, let's do that because I think
the seats are pretty close together. That might not be a good idea.
I can't get their arms free. So.
The reason I say that is whoever wants. I would guess nobody wants to go first because they figure they can't refute. Mr. Knickerbocker, maybe whoever you guys want, go first, and then we'll give you just 1 minute to respond to anything that needs to be responded to. But I let's just hear that, and then the other two, the one Senator Anderson talked about, and whoever the cable companies would like to have present their side. Reyes. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the conference committee, for the record, my name is Jerry Knickerbocker. On behalf of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, we were one of the original proponents of this particular Article 4 that's now in the bill. It was originally introduced as a freestanding bill. We started working on this 2 years ago, and we had meetings with the Minnesota Association of Cable Administrators, the League of Cities, and cable companies. We met for a while. Didn't really make any progress. We kind of talked about, you know, what was happening on the federal level and the move towards competition in the cable industry, and how common carriers were going to get into the cable industry, and how the FCC was sanctioning the entry of common carriers, such as telephone companies, into the cable industry. And one of the outcomes of our discussion was the drafting of a bill that we introduced last session for open video system providers to get into the cable business, so to speak, under a separate brand-new law called Chapter 238A. And we talked about that as a way to do cable entry for telcos. And we met with the cable administrators in the League of Cities over the course of the summer and fall, and came up with the bill that was introduced this legislative session, which is now Article 4 in the bill. And basically, for the benefit of the members, I'll pass out testimony that was offered in committee. One from the League supporting that. Another I'll hand out is from a small firm that has fiber to the home, different than cable, different than the telco service offering, vehicle by which they would get into the telecom business. And then the other article that I would hand out, Mr. Chairman, members, has to do with really just a summary of the bill. All times have changed. How the current state law is a barrier to entry for other types of providers. And I would call your attention, Mr. Chairman and members, to this handout that lays out very specifically what a telephone company can do as a cable company and what a cable company can do as a telephone company. Telcos would like to have the opportunity, the same opportunity that the cable companies have to compete against telephone companies in the telephone industry, to have the opportunity to offer cable and offer competition on the cable side. All this bill does is allow local municipalities the option of granting a franchise to a competitor under different terms for service area than what the incumbent presently has. And the old, outdated state law sets up a barrier to entry. It's not a level playing field. You can't get into the business unless you completely build out over the entire municipality. That creates a barrier to entry. It creates, and as you'll read that statement from John Schultz, at a 5-6-member employee firm trying to do fiber to the home. He makes some good points about the capital requirements, the difficulty of trying to, you know, start small business in the state of Minnesota in the way of trying to provide competition to cable companies. All this bill does is allow local option, a local choice. And I know many of you sitting around the table are for local control. And all that bill does is just give local municipalities, based on their set of circumstances, the option of granting a second franchise under different terms and conditions than what the incumbent might have. And without that change, there is a barrier to entry. People are forced to follow an outdated state law that municipalities are looking to change themselves. This isn't something that just, you know, telephone companies are interested in. People that actually, you know, grant the franchises are interested in change. They need to have some flexibility in terms of trying to provide competition and try to let new businesses and new service offerings and hopefully more choices and more prices come into their communities. And this is a vehicle to do it.
Any questions, members? Let's thank you, Mr. Knickerbocker. Let's ask Mr. Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. James Erickson, representing the Minnesota Cable Communications Association. And I, too, will pass out what you have seen before. The materials that we used for the floor discussion in the Senate. I think it is very succinct. This is a simple, straightforward issue. It is one of fair competition. Mr. Knickerbocker attempts to characterize the playing field as unlevel. The statute that is being amended, and I remind the committee that we're dealing with at least a 25-year-old statute, which was and is still, appropriately, we believe, the public policy of the state. That is, that if you are granted the right and the privilege of building and the obligation of building a cable television system, the cities insisted, going back as far as the 80s when these franchises were granted, that the entire community be served. Otherwise, in the city of Minneapolis, perhaps only the Kenwood might have cable television to use, to pick one example. The cities very appropriately had many, many requirements at the time that the cable companies back that long ago made enormous investments and continue to have many, many requirements as the cable companies have continued to make millions of dollars of investments in upgrading their plant. The communities had a public interest in insisting and that the cable company had, with the right that it had to build, it had the obligation to serve all the communities. That's the essence of this issue. And I believe that is a level playing field. It's state policy, and I think it makes good sense. Senator Kelly very articulately argues that we want to create an exception to that, and there might be a reason for doing that. That is, we should have competition. We believe the Minnesota Cable Communications Association is very much in favor of competition, but we believe it has to be fair competition. And I really ask you, I don't know if it was this document that Mr. Knickerbocker passed out, this was the document that was circulated on the floor, the Senate floor debate, the document saying supporting keeping Article 4 in, and I make two points about that, and I would like to damn their argument with their own language. First of all, I believe it's disingenuous to argue, as Mr. Knickerbocker did, that it's not fair that we as a cable, that they as a telephone company can't come into only a part of the city of Minneapolis, whereas we as a cable company can go anywhere we want. That's not true. It's just simply we have different service areas. We have service areas that are based on municipal boundaries, sometimes multiple municipal boundaries. By joint powers agreements. The telephone industry has grown up in a much different way. They're not municipal boundary sensitive. The telephone company that has the right to serve an area serves many areas, sometimes even county, not tied to county or city or municipal lines. So to suggest, and it's very clever, I think, to suggest that it's not fair where it says here what cable companies can do and what telephone companies can't, it's simply not apples to apples. The issue is very simple. is the public purpose served? Are all of your constituents well served by allowing a telephone company or any competitor, it happens to be a local telephone company asking for this right now, arising out of a particular circumstance where the city said to them, no, you're required to have a cable television franchise, and the cable television franchise law now requires you to serve the whole city. Service and provide that, those very important PEG access channels, public educational and government access channels to everyone. It's very simple. You're balancing two interests, the interest of having more competition in this marketplace versus protecting the entire community. We think that's simple. We think the public policy of the state for this many years should remain. Competition can come and will come in many other forms. These are non-exclusive franchises. And we respectfully suggest that the policy that has been the policy for a long time not be repealed, that you made the right decision long ago, and we would only, for very great reason that I think is not demonstrated by this, do harm to the cable industry and let them to be competed with by someone who can cherry-pick, if I may use that term, a small area, without having to make the capital investment and provide the, across the service area. I would say, I'd say only further, Mr. Chairman, by way of conclusion, then I'll be happy to answer questions. The other suggestion, and I think it is very appropriate, Senator Anderson's question about communities. We are the cable industry, and we are obviously mindful and ask for fair competition. But there is another party at the table, and those are the cities. And I think it's fair to say that unlike the representations in this handout about the positions of the Minnesota Cable Television Administrators, for example, in the cities, I think it's fair to ask them now, because as this has become more clear, I think the issues are more problematic, and I think at least a number of entities are much more concerned about this than they were before.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Erickson, in the handout, you notice about 40 different cities have awarded at least one other cable franchise. Are any of those actually building out to this point?
Mr. Erickson. Representative Biden, Mr. Chairman. Indeed, the franchises have been awarded. Sometimes it's two franchises, and they, because the franchise is awarded, it's required to be built out, have built out the whole city. That's indeed happening, and it's happened wherever that franchise has been awarded, and we think that's good policy.
Mr. Chairman. How do the PEG things work out? Do we have duplicate or triplicate sets of community access channels and so on and so forth?
Mr. Chairman, that's almost a case-by-case basis, but generally there are interconnection agreements negotiated between the two competitors or the three competitors, so that there is a minimum of duplication. Sometimes that happens because you grant more than one facility. But by and large, to my knowledge, and there are others in the room who have more practical experience with that, the fact that the franchise was required to be granted and cover the whole area has worked well. The system has worked well. Many second and third competitors have lived with current state law that A, franchise is required, and B, the franchise has to cover the whole area, and C, it has to provide the same kind of. In other words, if you're a competitive customer of a, I guess there's no term in this cable industry for a, if you're a CLEC, cable CLEC, so to speak, a second, and because sometimes they are telephone companies that are competitors, sometimes they're other cable companies, sometimes they are others.
So, Mr. Erickson, so basically there's probably duplication going on in several of them that have worked it out where everyone just provides the same stuff?
I think the answer is at the customer level, no customer has been disadvantaged by losing PEG access channels by the fact that there are two or three. I don't think they've gotten
Been disadvantaged by having to buy the same equipment and try to get it in the city council chambers or wherever they've got to do it?
I think not, Mr. Chairman. I'm at least not familiar with any circumstance, although, as I say, there are others in the room who might
justify the incumbent providers let the competitors just rent their equipment or pay them a lease so they only have to have one set of equipment?
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering whether, Mr. Gibbs, would you be have you had that experience in the Comcast case? I know that several of our members have been, if you will, overbuilt, and Mr. Gibbs probably has some of that experience as the operator.
Mr. Gibbs.
Mr. John Gibbs.
Do you know the answer to that?
Mr. Chairman, John Gibbs, Vice President of Comcast. We have cable systems in Minnesota and 30 states, and we have many occurrences where there are multiple franchise holders. And Mr. Erickson is right, it will depend on the situation. This statute requires essentially equal obligations, but often we will work out ways so that we don't unnecessarily duplicate, and rather we share facilities, we might share programming, so there wouldn't be three sets of cameras at a city hall. And this statute currently provides for that, and it works. The proposed amendment we don't think would ultimately end up in equal burdens. We think there might be different burdens. The first one would have more burdens than the second one, assuming that was in the franchise agreement that the city negotiated with the second one. So currently, yes, it works, and the burdens are the same but not identical.
All right, Senator Gaither.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Erickson and Mr. Gibbs, this has been a very complicated exercise at many levels, and it's been my experience going through this last iteration that a majority of the folks who have a dog in this fight have been compromising behind the scenes and collaborating on various proposals and solutions. One of the questions that I've got that came up on the Senate floor and seems to come up in some testimony here this evening is, have you been able to work at any compromise language that both parties could live with, or do, is my impression accurate in that we're at an impasse here? Could you give me a status report of what has happened, looking at all the other stakeholders in the room, there's been, by and large, a lot of angst going through the exercise that was in front of us right now, and I was just interested in hearing your perspective on the efforts to arrive at some type of an agreement for this point.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gaither, on the Senate floor, it was characterized that the cable industry had been unwilling to compromise or discuss compromise. I think that's incorrect. This is, though, a fairly simple issue. I mean, you either protect the sanctity of the public policy that says the second franchise should not be more favorable or less burdensome than the first. There are ways to compromise that, but they would require some articulate language that would put some limitations, I think, strong ones and serious ones, we would argue, upon the community, upon the municipality that would want to do that, to say that they would ensure that their build-out schedule, for example, that all of the services of the cable enterprise be available to all residents. It's really that simple. I mean, I guess you could say here would be a compromise, it would be a compromise to say that you don't have to build the whole area of a town, you only have to build half of it. Does that make sense? I mean, this isn't it seems to me a compromise, and you have two distinct areas that can be rewritten, but I think a compromise in this case, not that we were not willing to talk about one, and certainly Senator Kelly has always held the door open to say if there's some other good idea. We frankly haven't found a good way or a good idea, but if some of the bright members of this committee and the industry want to suggest that to us, we'd certainly work with it. But it seems to me you're either saying you're going to protect the sanctity of every consumer in that city has the right to the benefits of that second franchisee or third, or you're going to say only a percentage of them are. And then I think you've kind of thrown out the baby with the bathwater.
Senator Kelly. Go ahead, and then I think we'll get the third group up, and then I'm thinking now Mr. Erickson and Nick Rocker could come back just at the very end and finish up any closing.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Erickson, one of the good things about the bill this year is that we have both telecom and the cable issues together. And you talk about the sanctity of the fair terms. Would you comment on the differences between incumbent telephone carriers and competitive local exchange carriers in the telephone business, where we have encouraged competition by requiring a lesser burden on the new entrants and why we ought not adopt that policy if we want to encourage competition in the cable business.
Mr. Erickson.
I'll make a quick response to that, and I'd like to ask Mr. Gibbs to weigh in also. I think we're dealing with competition and the requirement that the area served be the same. And while clearly in the telecom industry, in the telecom business, there has been a public policy aimed at attempting to reduce the burdens and allow competitors to come in so to serve an individual. In the case of the telephone, the cable industry, again, where we are really viewed as, and I would argue with a monopoly term, but we're given the right of way, use of the right of way, and therefore we have some obligations. And one of those obligations is to serve the whole community. I think it's that simple. I don't think the telecom competition analogy is applicable. I with all due respect, I think it in the business of cable television, we're using public right of way, and we have the obligation to serve everyone.
That's Chairman, one other quick question, which I hope there's a quick answer to. Mr. Erickson, during the original build-out, at the very beginning of the cable industry in Minnesota, how long were the build-out terms typically for providers in cities?
I was there at that time, Chairman and Senator Kelly. But generally, to my knowledge, is my recollection going back now 20 years, I don't think there was a cable franchise, at least in the metropolitan area, of any significant size that allowed more than a three-year build-out. My recollection strikes me as that was about the maximum phases, but no longer than they. That's, and I think, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gibbs had a response to Senator Kelly's question.
Mr. Gibbs.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kelly, to the first question on competition, Comcast competes in three lines of businesses: video, cable television, telephone, and internet service. In Minnesota, we've invested $250 million in the last 3 years to upgrade our $1.2 billion systems to offer those services. And an incentive to do that has been an expectation about what the level playing field would be here in Minnesota. And we've made substantial capital investment based on and risk investment based on an expectation that others in one sector or another will be in the same place. The contrast to the telephone analogy, and we are in the telephone business, is that the infrastructure that the 96 Act suggested be shared on certain regulated terms was infrastructure in place, fundamentally infrastructure in place, paid for with ratepayers, rate of return, money. All of the new competitors' investment and all of the cable investment, regardless of whether we're in the cable business or our phone business or our internet business, is all risk capital investment brought here to Minnesota because we knew, and we borrowed this money, by the way, because we knew that in any given city, the rules would be such that anybody else would have to make the same kind of investment, so that when we invested in Frogtown, we knew that someone wouldn't pick Crocus Hill only. We invested in Frogtown and Crocus Hill. We invested in the whole town. And we could do that, and banks would lend us money to do that because they knew someone wouldn't pick a town, pick a neighborhood of high margin only. So it's a very different scheme because this is risk capital brought in to invest.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Killen.
Mr. Gibbs, you triggered a thought. I heard a story recently that in order to get a cable company to build out to an office park, since the cable company is typically built to the residential areas, that the cable company was demanding that the subscriber pay the cost of the build-out to the office park, whereas the telephone company would have been expected to provide that infrastructure at its own cost. Are you familiar with any instances like that where you're, when you talk about serving the whole community, I'm wondering whether you're serving the whole business community?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kelly, The answer would be this, that as it relates to the cable system's policy on that, the statute now would say any cable system, anybody holding a cable franchise, in other words, both cable companies, if there were two, would be held to the same policy. So we're talking about fairness that way. In practice, the company, the cable company, would only be in a position of requesting contribution for an extension if the locally granted franchise, in other words, the local law, specifically provided for that. And if it did for one operator, it would provide the same for the second operator. And this proposal would change that. It would say 20-pound weight for this guy, 10-pound weight for this person.
Thank you, Mr. Gibbs.
Why don't we ask for this? Who do you want?
Mr. Chair, I know our St. Paul person is not available. Michael Bradley is here, and he represents a number of the cities. He would be helpful. So I don't know.
Mr. Bradley, do you have?
Bradley. Mm-hmm.
Bradley.
Mm-hmm. I don't know who else is here from the city.
Mr. Bradley, you want to offer some brief comments?
Very brief. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mike Bradley. I'm a partner with the law firm of Creighton, Bradley, and Gazzetta. And we represent local governments across the Twin Cities, from Anoka down through Eagan, including the city of Minneapolis. I'm here to speak this evening against Article 4. We believe that Article 4 needs more work, needs more discussion between the cities, the cable operators, as well as the Telephone Association. And we identified another article in this bill that was troublesome earlier on in this session, and we were successful in working out our differences in that bill, and we were very pleased with that. That's old Article 11. I'm not sure which article it is now in the bill. And the result of that, if this legislation passes through this evening and to the respective floors, will be the first substantial change to the Minnesota Cable Act in many, many years. In addition, there was a recent court decision that ruled already that cities have...
Mr. Brad, I'm going to need you to speed it up a little.
It will. I'll be very quick. Okay. Thank you. That existing... cities already have authority to be flexible in how they franchise competitive franchise applicants. So, to sum up, there's no urgency to pass this legislation. There's already law in place. This article needs more work. There are plenty of articles in this bill that have been agreed upon. And I would urge this committee to accept Article 4 going forward. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Kelly. And then I've got to call a recess for us. I've just been informed we need to get upstairs for a little bit. So
very quick Senator question,
Kelly, and then
Brad.
We'll have to recess.
Bradley, you know how long ago this provision passed the committee. And I also know that you've been working on the old Article 11. So how is it that we could get to this point in the session and suddenly hear from you and or your clients that there's a problem with Article 4 when everybody else that had a problem with Senate File 2774 has been beating down the door to mine and Representative Westrom's office for the last month or month and a half? I'm curious about the timing of saying that this article needs more work.
Mr. Chair and members, cities aren't always as quick to respond as maybe private companies. And the fact of the matter is, our cities finally got around to reviewing this legislation, and they've identified concerns. And I'm not the only one that's identified those concerns.
Mr. Chairman, I know that we have to recess. Maybe Mr. Bradley, during the break, could give me a really precise
listing of the particular language items that cause concern.
Yeah. Mr. Bradley, could you do that?
Or Mr. Kelly?
And I just leave us before recess with this parting thought on that same note. Mr. Bradley, other cable providers, I continually hear that it's hard to get you to negotiate anything. So you tell me when we come back what you're going to do to negotiate things short of this legislation, because it appears that that might be the only way we get people to the table.
So are you talking about me personally or
cities? No, city. You're the group you're representing. I don't know what you
negotiated personally.
Mr. Chairman, how long do you think the recess will be?
I would say 20 minutes.
Okay. He didn't tell us, but we'll...
How about 10:30? It's 10 o'clock right now.
Very good.
Let's say 10:30.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll call the conference committee back to order.
Oh, you got the tape on?
Yep.
Okay.
Folks, at this point, Representative Vandeveer is here as well, and I'd like him to be a part of the discussion on the cell phone discussion. So with that, let's just move. We're going to set aside Article 4 discussion and move into Mr. Eloff. What number was that? Article?
I believe we're...
At 6?
Article 6, yes.
Let's just review the differences of Mr. Eloff and then... see if we can come up with a solution.
The major differences in reference to this article is that the House language requires providers to give 30 days notice of a substantive provider-initiated contract change, and the Senate requires 60 days notice. The House specifies how a customer must be notified of a provider-initiated substantive change, and there's no comparable provision in the Senate. In the House, a substantive contract change initiated by the provider becomes effective unless the customer opts out affirmatively in writing and terminates the contract within the 30-day notice period. The Senate language specifies that the contract change becomes effective only if the customer affirmatively opts in writing within the 60-day notice period. And the Senate also specifies that a provider must clearly disclose to a customer contract changes resulting from a customer-initiated change. There's nothing similar in House provision. And it was Mr. Fuller also pointed out another difference. You may wish to repeat.
Mr. Fuller, you want to just repeat those differences?
The triggering definition for a lot of obligations is substantive. And the Senate includes in the definition of substantive change something that could extend the duration of the contract as well as the price. So that's a significant difference.
So the Senate defines substantive changes, extending the contract or increasing the price. Representative Vandeveer, I know you worked on some this afternoon. Did you have any suggestions on how we could marry these two proposals up?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I had a couple. I do think that the substantive change from the Senate is better, maybe a little bit, that portion. I think that we did plagiarize, I think, from Senator Anderson's committee, the notification in the House bill. I think that's where that came from, and we added it in. So I think the notification language is good, but possibly maybe switching the substantive change definition and the copy of the contract, I think, was more permissive regarding an electronic notification from the Senate. It was clear in that regard. So those two might be good to exchange. Otherwise, I think the House version seems a little simpler overall and easier to comply with and understand.
Representative Vandeveer, did you visit with the AG's office on that today?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Yes, I did. And the AG's office hasn't... The conversation ended with the impression that he was going to do some checking, and I haven't discussed it with him since then. That was several hours ago.
Well,
I think they like the opt-in language. If
I guess I would raise the biggest concern that the House didn't support is the opt-in language, but I'm just wondering if there's a way we could compromise some of with the Senate or House language, but maybe look at the 60-day instead of the 30, or...
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beard.
I was just thinking the opt-out from a business or a logistical perspective is a lot easier and cleaner for the providers to handle, but I really like the Senate 60-day notice period, so if we move things along, I'll move to adopt the House language on opting out by the customer and the Senate language on 60-day period for them to do that.
Mr. Chairman, Beard moves we adopt the House language on the opt-out and the Senate language on the 60-day notice period. Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, the opt-in language was adopted after debate in Senator Anderson's committee on Senator Bachman's bill, which was the companion to Representative Vanderveer's bill. And there was pretty strong support on the Senate floor for the opt-in language. No one tried to take it out, and the bill had a pretty strong bipartisan support. So taking out the opt-in was not something that the Senate could agree to. I mean, if there's concern about combining the opt-in and too long a notice, there's potential for change there, and I know that one of the providers was suggesting that, at least in the industry, the concept of an adverse material change was more commonly understood than a substantive change. So I think the Senate could, you know, work with that kind of concept as long as we had the opt-in. If the providers were concerned about the term substantive change, with all due respect to Representative Beard, I don't think he's quite found the sweet spot on the compromise.
Is there someone from the AG's office here today, tonight?
I don't know. I haven't seen them, Mr. Chairman.
You don't know? Representative Beard.
If I could ask Senator Kelly to explain a little more, because the thought intrigues me about the substantive change thing. If I remember, what we're trying to do here is we're trying to protect customers from, for instance, buy a new cell phone and then find out that, their contract has been extended from the day the new cell phone showed up without their assent or anything like that. Mischief like that is what we're trying to prevent or from happening. Knowing billing cycles and people paying attention to their mail and whatnot, it's why the 60-day cycle appeals to me. But describe to me again your concerns about the substantive change and the, what we're... I'm trying to get my arms around that.
Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, Mr. Holton, who represents Verizon, was, obviously expressed some concern about the opt-in language, but was also suggesting that, and I don't know, I did not see a precise amendment from him, but what I did see was a conceptual description that that Verizon felt that the concept of an adverse material change.
Adverse material change.
Was something that they were more familiar with, but I don't have the definition of that. We may see if Mr. Holton has that in handy.
Holton. Court. Mr. Chair, I got to tell you,
he's coming to the table, Mr. Chairman.
Plow real deep, but I think it's important we understand the definition of the term before we decide whether we're going to make the customers opt in or opt out before they
Mr. Holton, can you just give us a quick explanation of that concept?
Good evening, members. My name is Court Holton. I represent Verizon Wireless.
The term material adverse is used already in the industry, in the specifically in the termination rights that are in the contracts. Now, the reason that I was speaking to Senator Kelly and others regarding that issue is that I think it's far more functional than the attempts to try to define what a substantial change is, and the aspects of adverse material as adverse, it's not in your favor, and material is that it's related to the relationship, the contractual relationship, and it's at least of some significance. It's not a nothing change.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair,
I'm
trying to narrow this down too. How would that be different from what's defined in here? I mean, this refers to an increase in the charge or an increase or an extension of the term of the contract specifically. So what could it include besides that?
Those members, those two would obviously be, if they were not in your favor, adverse and definitely material. Mm-hmm. There are many other changes that are made, and they're different. They could affect different users under the same plan differently. Mm-hmm. You could change your rate and add much more quality to the plan, or you could shift areas, adjust areas. It could be great for one person. It could be not great for another person. It's more, I don't think that concept is difficult. I think that the concept of substantial change, other than the obvious examples like those that you gave, which probably constitute, you know, the bulk of what you're talking about, the rest of it is lies in the unknown, that those terms do not have industry usage, and especially if you use the concept of could have, then I think, which is I think in the Senate position but not in the House position, that the House position says that it does have and the Senate position says that it could have. When you get to could have, then at that point, anything, any argument is conceivable. And I don't see these things so much going to, you know, judges aren't going to be deciding these things. It's got to be decided, you know, between the two parties. That's where your most efficient means of resolution is going to be. Not that that's always going to work.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vanderbilt, what do you think?
I wasn't sure if it was finished. I don't see the problem with substantive change. I think it's clear, and I feel that I understand it. Staff has looked at it. I don't know if anyone else is confused by it. The definition is there. But with regard to the opt-in, one of the problems that came up was, and the biggest concerns is after the notification goes out, and I think there's some truth that we could end up making this more difficult for consumers and taking away options for them if we do that.
They don't happen to respond.
Well, yeah, if they don't respond, I mean, what does that mean? How many times do they have to be contacted? It could turn into something that ends up costing everybody more money, and it kind of does complicate the whole process. I mean, the cellular industry is evolving, and they do have to be able to change and deal with changes in the environment that's there. And overall, that's benefited consumers. And I'm concerned that if, you know, it's my bill and I want to see it to fruition, but if we make it more difficult or complicated too much, we're going to end up hurting the people we're trying to help.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Senator, I think that's what my suggestion was attempting to accomplish, was that if the industry was concerned about the language used in
both the House and the Senate versions of this with respect to substantive change, that we could try to be reflective of industry practice in the definition and the terms we used as part of the compromise on this. And, you know, as part of that, I obviously would be suggesting that we keep the Senate language on opt-in, and I know Mr. Holden doesn't favor that. But I, in trying to find some middle ground, I was trying to identify whether the adverse material change language would help to get us there. I understand his points about how a service change, you know, depending on how it was balanced, might be good for some customers and adverse for other customers, and that they, you know, and then in that case, the company would be giving notice to the folks adversely affected and not doing anything with the folks positively affected, so it would be less burdensome for them.
Chair?
Senator?
Thank you. Just as a practical question, let us say for the sake of discussion purposes that we're adding my 16-year-old son to our bucket plan, and that we are going to go now from 1,500 minutes to 2,000 minutes, but because of adding my son, that 2,000 minutes is a lower rate. I'm still going to pay a higher cost for my overall bill, but because of adding my son, I get a third phone at arguably a discount. Under the opt-out provision, do I have to then wait to respond to the vendor to say I want this plan, or can I get the plan implemented and the phone activated and operate in that regard? Is that an adverse effect, or how would that be interpreted?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gaither, and maybe Representative Vanderveer has got something to add on this, but I think the other thing to keep in mind here is the difference between a customer-initiated change and a provider-initiated change. So, if you initiated that process of saying, I want to add my son, but I want to, you know, but in that process I'll get some other things rearranged too, that's not a provider-initiated change, and it's only the provider-initiated changes that trigger the opt-in, whether it's the opt-in or opt-out, and the notice provisions that are in the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I think.
I mean, we're just focusing on if the provider makes a change. Well, I don't know where we're going to find the middle ground here. I think the opt-in is quite problematic in the House, but the 60-day language I don't think is adverse material, or material adverse isn't. But Senator Kelly, you got any suggestions?
Mr. Chairman, I recognize that there are some challenges with Article 4 and some of the language concerns raised there and some challenges here. I think given the time pressure, we may want to take a vote on Representative Beard's motion just to see, you know, see where things are at. But the Senate feels pretty strongly about the opt-in, I think, and so the options are to find some compromise relatively quickly on what would be the trade-off for opt-in language, or simply not include the article in the bill. And I recognize we're kind of running that challenge with potentially with Article 4 as well. Mm-hmm. So Representative Vanderveer, don't feel picked on.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoppe.
We have the advantage here of Representative Vanderveer, the author of that particular article. Other than the opt-out, opt-in language, I mean, can we get to the point where we have common ground other than that? Or will that float AG? Will that give us problems with the AG? Or what can we live with here?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vanderveer.
Representative Hoppe, I think you know, if we focus on where we what the people have today versus what they'd have if either one of these were to become law, providing them some protection. And keep in mind, we're just doing two things. One, we wanted verified and records that the customer did agree to a contract in the first place. And number two, if a unilateral change is made in that contract by the provider, the customer's off the hook. That was really the goal of the legislation. It's a good first step. And I think it's kind of incumbent on the Senate, maybe, if you could help us, and you have been, Senator Kelly, I think, given us some good ideas. And I think you clearly understand the bill. And the other, I don't see any major difference except that opt-in at this point, except I really like the mailing provision. I like it more than the opt-in and waiting to 60 days, but I think either one is going to accomplish the goal, but the opt-in is very problematic when we get it back to the House, as you said, Mr. Chair, and that's my concern.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoppe.
Maybe we can reach common ground here. If are you willing to give up everything else other than the opt-in, so at least we're that far? And I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No, Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe.
Somebody's going to be on the spot.
I don't think I'm giving anything up if I were to do that.
But, I mean, you know, I think
I mean,
we want to
look. I say I am, but I think Senator Kelly knows.
I think you're giving up a lot.
But,
tried, Joe.
Let me ask a question.
I certainly won't kill the bill over it, I guess.
John, Mr. Fuller, what is the notice provision in the Senate versus the House? The House has a separate mailing. Does the Senate do the same thing?
Well, we have two. Because we have the provider initiated change, and we have. On the provider one, the provider must notify the customer in writing of any proposed substantive change in the contract between the provider and the customer 60 days before the change. So that's on the provider initiated one. When the customer does it, the provider just has to notify the customer and effect the change. Because we have two different sources.
Read the last one again.
Sorry.
I was mumbling.
I apologize. If the customer, this is the customer initiating the change. If the customer proposes to the provider any change in the terms of the existing contract, the provider must clearly disclose to the customer, orally or electronically, any change to the existing contract terms that would result from the customer's proposed change. Including but not limited to contract duration and price. So the customer's proposed change is only effective if the provider agrees to proposed change and the customer agrees to any resulting changes in the contract. The provider must maintain recorded or electronic communication. So because of the difference in the nature of the bills, there's two sets of notes.
Well,
Mr. Chairman,
I'm sorry, you wanted the House provision read too?
No, that's fine. We just got a separate mailing, I believe, in the House provision.
Mr. Chairman, you know, we're all under some time pressure here, but maybe if Representative Vanderveer, you know, rather than try to call on Representative Vanderveer for a decision right now, maybe we, you know, Representative Beard withdrew his motion, we could go on and talk about the deregulation article, and that would give Representative Vanderveer an opportunity to maybe pencil out something and see if there's a trade-off, you know, that sort of balances the, you know, from an industry perspective, that balances keeping the opt-in provision. If that's still the hang-up, then I think we have to make some other decisions. But if there's something that could be reached, maybe we ought to give Representative Vanderveer an opportunity to work on that.
Would that work, Representative Vanderveer?
If that's your desire, Mr. Chairman.
Why don't you talk it over for a few minutes if Representative Beard would just withdraw his motion at this time.
I'm happy to withdraw the motion to keep things moving along, Mr. Chair.
Let's try that and see if we can get something.
10 minutes, yes.
It's the AGs.
Mr. Chair, we can fix this about the AG. Just my observation.
Let me ask more.
He lives in Burnsville, though.
Can I ask a little more political restraining type question, Senator Kelly?
Yeah.
Okay.
Then I think let's move into Article 9.
And Mr. Chair, I hesitate a little bit to speak for the AG, but it's my understanding from what I've discussed with them previously that they feel very strongly about the opt-in provision, as you might
see,
expect.
The thing that puzzles me with that is they didn't argue adamantly for it or against the opt-out in the House side, and that's what we didn't have those
mm-hmm.
indications in the House, which leads us to believe that they'd either change their position or it wasn't as strong as they. And in the House, this provision wouldn't be here otherwise. So I guess that's my concern, and I just wish they would have raised the issue with us at the proper time, if that was truly a deal breaker, which it didn't seem to be at the time. But,
Bill, did you want to ask?
I did,
Senator Kelly.
And this is sort of a horse trading type question,
Senator Kelly.
I've got some thoughts about this Article 6. I think we're talking about here with Representative Randevier's bill, but Article 4 is where my real passion is. How closely would you like to connect the two? Or should we move on to deregulation and come back?
Representative, Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, I think maybe we ought to move on. Mr. Fuller had a constructive suggestion, which I'm going to urge Representative Vandeveer to consider as a way out of this predicament, and we'll see whether he's... how that consideration process goes.
In other words, horse trading on this may not be necessary. I'll save my horse.
There may be some other options before we have to trade the whole horse.
Okay.
Did I mention that with my motion?
Yes,
what were you suggesting, Senator Kelly?
Well, I think Representative Vandeveer ought to have a chance to sort of think about it and talk with some folks and before we...
Oh, okay. That's not a suggestion for them.
I don't want to put Representative Vandeveer on the spot with making a quick decision on it, so Mr. Fuller can explain it to him privately, and then he can decide how he wants to approach
okay.
it.
Okay. Let's then move on to Article 9.
Representative, I understand you have some
language after that. No, you're talking to Representative Beard now.
Representative Beard. Both got to be in your name. I know this is an issue that hasn't moved in the House. Let's throw out the language, if you'd like, Representative Beard, and move it, and then...
If I may, Mr. Chair.
...up for discussion.
Does our House staffer, Mr. Eloff... we had talked a little earlier about drawing a couple amendments to this section 7, 8, or 9.
Article 7.
7.
All 7.
Article 7 we're dealing with here. There's been some, of course, strong discussion. A whole parade of wonderful new friends have been beating a path to my door about this whole thing. We did not hear this in the House, and so we're going to be kind of doing committee work here. I don't want to get into that tonight. But a couple things I think that kind of tamp down some concerns with wanting to move ahead with the beginning to deregulate, particularly the Quest in this case, and the ability to compete against some of the CLECs. Some of our CLEC friends have some concerns, and I share those also. So one of the things they're talking about is predatory pricing and their fear that somehow Quest is going to come into a territory and undersell, sell it below cost, which I think we already have some statutes about that. So we've asked Mr. Eloff if there's a way we can reference the ability of the Commission to have some sort of penalty authority if a competitive exchange would come in and say, whoa, foul, they're selling to our customers and taking them away from us at less than worth, having to pay Quest for the wholesale dial tone, and some sort of a compensation for that, or some sort of a penalty that could be applied. I think the specific sections of the law that's been recommended to me is section 237.461 and 462.
speaking just largely about this section, my first conclusion was, we didn't even talk about it. Why are we doing this? But we recognize this is a two-party or a two-body legislature, and you folks did. We didn't. So I'm going to try to be a little accommodating here and ask if you can work with me by allowing some penalty authority for the commission to, so there's some relief if there's a perception that somehow the major carrier is anti-competitive or pricing predatorily. That's my first motion. Maybe okay. I have to ask Mr. Eloff if he's got the precise language.
Do you have that, Mr. Eloff?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The language that we that we're proposing to add here would say violations of the provision in this section shall be enforced under sections 237.461 and 237.462. Those statutes currently listed are the statutes for enforcement of telecommunications, the entire telecommunications chapter providing for civil penalties and administrative penalty authorities imposed by the commission. A bit of a footnote here. In drawing up the amendment, I noticed that in the very fine print, most of these enforcement penalties are scheduled to sunset as of the end of this year. And I added some language to the amendment that would extend the expiration date of those provisions until August 1st, 2009.
And thank you, Mr. Eloff.
Yeah, really. Why did we do that, and when did we do that? I'm just curious.
1999.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, I'm sure there was a bit of horse trading involved in that, too.
Only imagine.
we don't do something on that, it sunsets in 7 months.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, though, you know, I think consideration of the range of enforcement options is important. That question came up, and I was informed that there are already relevant criminal penalties that might apply, and I didn't get the citation back yet. So, so I'm trying to figure out whether we already in effect have some enforcement authority that we're not paying attention to that's not in 237, it's in another
section,
another chapter. So let me maybe Mr. Schreiner could inform us about that. Mr.
Andy, you here?
Oh, he's there. He's slinking down in his chair, trying to be invisible.
You have another?
Yeah, a couple.
Yeah,
Mike's got a couple more. The criminal penalty. I'm not sure. I feel real comfortable. I'm happy about criminalizing this business activity when it's just. Didn't seem to rise to that level. I like the civil penalty.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure, since I didn't actually have a chance to get the citation and read the provision, I'm talking about something that's in current law that would apply to anti-competitive conduct. And so it may be something we should keep in mind in context before we add something else on to this language.
The one thing to remember,
what
the provisions we're referring to. What's that?
The provisions relating to civil penalties.
They're already current law also.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, for the sake of the argument, let me just press ahead then with my preference that they be civil penalties and that we extend this out to 2009. Being a fan of sunsets myself, we'll let a future legislature decide if they're still a good idea, roll them ahead. If they're not, well, they'll come off. But I have no problem, and we do this frequently, I'm sure, of putting things in statute in several places, and if it doesn't conflict, unless somebody wants to bring criminal charges in one place and civil charges in another, I would speak in preference of the civil charges in this section.
So, Representative Beard, I'm wondering, you've got some other concerns.
Yeah.
It's easier to get, look at everything at once. Senator Kelly and...
Can we just lay them all on the table now, or do you want to discuss both of them?
Senator Kelly, what would you prefer to...
Because I imagine...
Mr. Chairman...
the whole thing would look like...
I think that... Yeah, I think that would be very helpful if we... If we could see sort of...
You know where we're going with this?
Representative Beard's vision for how it would look.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Kelly and Representative Beard, will it fall under the purview of our conference committee to change something in current statute that's not in this legislation from criminal to civil?
No, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hoppe, I'm not proposing that we change anything.
Okay.
What was in a very brief conversation suggested to me was that an existing provision that provides criminal penalties for anti-competitive conduct would apply to the kind of predatory pricing behavior that is being regulated in this language, so that additional specification of penalties was unnecessary.
Okay.
I think that was the argument being made to me, but I have, as I said, I haven't seen the citation.
Yeah, I was just looking for a clarification.
Yes.
Well, rather than working from Mr. Chairman,
Representative Beard.
Sorry. Rather than working from Cliff's notes here, Mr. Eloff did prepare a 16-line amendment, which is in front of you, which really does lay out
everything
here.
Yeah, that you were talking about.
We were talking about earlier.
Why don't you just go through that?
Mr. Eloff?
No, I can go through it. I'll wait for Senator Kelly's. He's having data dumped in his ear. So no, go ahead, Jim.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, why don't you present this? I'm gonna have a conversation with Representative Vandiver and see if we can make some progress on that front. And okay. I'll try to keep an ear tuned to this conversation.
It could be the five of us can work this out while you're gone.
All in favor?
Oh, hold on. Let me explain it first. There are a couple things that just occurred to me as I was looking through this and meditating on just what this did. The definition on page 11, line 29, of 20%, I'd like to see that raised to 30% before our friends at Quest can say, hey, we're now in a competitive situation. 30 is still not where I'd like to go, but I think it's a more reasonable number than 20. Page 12, line 11, before the search A, for some reason or another. Just reading right off the, this is the technical stuff. On page 12, after line 17, this is where the, if there's alleged violations, this is where the language would be inserted that we were discussing just a moment ago, to make it civil penalties to be applied by the commission.
Under 237.
Under 237, yeah, that would be on line 17. Then let's see. In section 2, we need to amend section 2 and 4. Okay, that's between lines 18 and 23, lines 24, so on and so forth. You see it there. That this is my fondness for sunset stuff. This is a major step we're taking here. If it's a good idea today, it'll probably be a good idea in 3 or 4 years. However, if it's not going well, and some of us aren't around to remember what we're talking about this evening, a future legislature will have to fix the mess in 5 years, or if things are going well, extend the sunset and remove it. This seems to me to be inexpensive insurance to just kind of insure against general mayhem and mischief if we're missing something. Remember the section, I think down in section 4, on line 16 of my amendment, that the provisions of this section, this is the general sunset provided, expire August 1st, 2009. Section 2 and 4, I think, deal with the public utilities. Extended, yes, this is where Mr. Eloff got the expirations of sunsets that were put in place in 1999. That's what we're changing on line 19 and line 24. Do you follow all that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're lengthening current sunsets so that they match subdivision request and we put in for the entire.
That's under 237, right?
Correct.
Mr. Chair?
Can, copy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I ask one clarification?
Okay.
On the amendment, line number 4, where it says page 12, line 11, before the insert A.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Why?
Why am I not seeing that?
Because we're adding a paragraph B on line 6.
Okay. Gotcha.
Okay, let me.
Hey, Mr. Representative Beard.
I'm trying to find what Hawk just did here. Page 12, line 11.
Because of the next line over, inserting the paragraph B.
Gotcha.
Another
okay.
paragraph.
Understood. I see it.
Mr. Fuller.
Line 16 of the amendment.
Hmm.
Does the provisions of this section expire? This section is an expiration section. Is it provisions of the article, or what are you referring to in line 16?
Line 16 refers to this entire article, section 1 of the article.
So it's provision of section 1,
mm, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
My intention was that the entire article would be sunsetted on August 1st, 2009, unless it was working well and a previous or subsequent legislature would remove it.
So on line 16, you should delete the section and insert article to reflect
here? You know, that'd be...
Mr. Chair, I think it would have the same effect because Section 2, all Section 2 is a couple of reports that will be done before then anyway. So either way would be have the same effect, I would think.
Section.
I mean, Section 1 is basically the substance.
Section.
It doesn't. Either way is fine.
Doesn't matter. I mean, this
no,
one.
Well, Section 2 is some
reports.
Some plan. It's not. I'm not saying it's not substantive, but it's not.
They're going to be done by 09 anyway.
Exactly.
So you can sunset them all you want.
You got it. doesn't matter.
That makes sense to you, Mr. Fuller?
I mean, the articles may be simpler.
I think it's not drafted.
Correct. Okay. I agree with Mr. Fuller that we're missing something here.
First, I mean, I would say that Section 2, on line 8, you have an amendment to a session.
It's in Section 3.
And what are those session laws that we were talking about that were in here?
Okay.
Is this an accurate representation of the 1999 session law?
The session law is...
Law?
Yeah, the session law is in line 10 to 12. With the exception...
What are these? What is Section 2 and 4 of the session law?
That is referring to the sections in the... session law that said that the civil penalties that we were talking about will sunset at the end of 2004.
So that language, that session law says that this section of statute is going to sunset at the end of 2004.
So you're making the sunset, excuse me. So expiring. Okay, got it. Extending it.
Mr. Chairman.
Expiring.
You're adding to the sunset the discussion here a little more confusion. I misspoke. On page 12, lines 19 and 24, there is sunset for January 15th of 2005, directing the PUC to do some things. Those sunsets are not addressed in my amendment. So. What Mr. Eloff has done is extended the ability, apparently, for them to level civil penalties. And then at the last line 16 of my amendment, the new Section 4, I agree with Mr. Fuller. I believe that my intention is that the provisions of this article expire August 1st, 2009. Is that what you were getting at, Mr. Fuller?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, yes. Like I said, I'm sorry I was talking. Somebody else from the discussion came, so I could just state what I think you're doing and you can tell me if I'm right. There are some civil penalties, apparently, that are currently set to expire by this 1999 statute.
Mm-hmm.
You are referencing those penalties on line 6 and 7 of your amendment. And why are you making these violations of those sections as opposed to leaving the bill the way it is? What is your...
In the bill that we have before us, I don't believe there are any penalties listed for anti-competitive or predatory pricing.
residing on some.
Spelled out in this bill.
If somebody wanted to raise an issue that somebody's not playing right, this would give them a provision in the PUC, a provision to assess fines and penalties. So,
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to figure out how that would be different. I guess it would be helpful to see the language of 461.461 and 462, but how is that? I mean, we have subdivision 6 enforcement that says the powers and duties granted to the commission apply to violations. A person aggrieved can file a complaint. So what do they do beyond that, those sections?
Chair, Senator Ellison, Anderson, where are you reading in the bill?
Subdivision 6 enforcement after the, on line 11,
page 12. Okay.
I don't know exactly what any of these statutory sections encompass. And Mr. Chair, it's on line 12, it says, well, it says the powers and duties granted to the commission by section 257.081 apply to violations of this section. So I'm not sure what that encompasses, as opposed to the sections that you're referencing. So that would be helpful to have an explanation.
Mr. Fuller has my statute book, my recollection is that 237.081 applies to the powers of the commission to investigate allegations of violations of these sections, but does not include any penalties depending on what is found as a result of those investigations. That's what this amendment incorporates.
And then, Mr. Chair, it says someone can file, the next sentence says that a person aggrieved by a violation can file a complaint under 237.081, but there's still no penalty?
Well, 237
has the penalty provision.
Mr. Chairman, I think 237.1 calls for the commission and the commission orders, which, you know, can.
Yes.
Coming back to that. But they're not.
Specific.
I mean, it's mostly oriented towards stopping behavior and correcting behavior. Looks like these provisions are much heavier sanctions.
Can you tell us, Mr. Chair or Council, what then 237.461 and 462? Okay.
I've got the book.
You can read it.
That's 461 and 462.
Yeah, looking at 461, subdivision 1 says this chapter and rules and orders of the commission adopted under this chapter may be enforced by any one or combination of criminal prosecution, action to recover civil penalties, injunction, action to compel performance, and other appropriate action. Subdivision 2, civil penalty. A person who knowingly and intentionally violates a provision of this chapter or rule or order of the commission adopted under this chapter shall forfeit and pay to the state a penalty in an amount to be determined by the court of at least $100 and not more than $5,000 for each day of violation. Subdivision 3 is entitled civil penalty for local competition violations. Notwithstanding subdivision 2, a person who knowingly and intentionally commits a violation described in section 237.462 subdivision 1, clauses 1 to 4, shall forfeit and pay to the state a penalty in an amount to be determined by the court of at least $100 and not more than $55,000 for each day of each violation. In determining the amount of the penalty under the subdivision, the court shall consider the factors in section 237.462 subdivision 2, paragraph B. Subdivision 4 indicates that those civil penalties shall, that are brought by the Attorney General must be paid into the State Treasury. And 237.462 is entitled Competitive Enforcement Administrative Penalty Orders. It's rather lengthy, but it talks about the authority of the Commission to issue administrative penalty orders for knowing and intentional violations of a number of the sections in the telecommunications law. Talks about the amount of those penalties, burden of proof.
What are the amounts of those penalties, just generally?
Sure. Commission may issue an order assessing a penalty of between $100 and $10,000 per day for each violation. In determining the amount of the penalty, the Commission shall consider the willfulness or intent of the violation and a whole list of criteria.
But 461's got the criminal side. 462 is...
461 is civil penalties. 462 is administrative penalty orders, one of the ways of...
But 61's got criminal also.
Not specifically in there. It mentioned at the beginning that this chapter may be enforced by one or any one or combination of criminal prosecution in addition to action to recover civil penalty.
Do you want all those enforcements?
Well, it sounds like you've given the commission a toolbox with all kinds of stuff, so if it's...
If and guns and shot.
Yeah. Aircrafts and everything else in there. So that we'll have to trust, if we leave this stand, we'll have to trust the good judgment of the commission as to whether they're going to give them a slap on the hand or...
I'm just... My thought in him reading it was, I'm wondering if we should just have 462 apply and not...
No. Mr. Fogan.
As a practical matter, what you're doing is you're extending these penalty provisions with respect to everybody. So we have a legislative decision 5 years ago that they were going to expire in 5 years with respect to what they applied to at the time. There must have been a reason for that. And now when we extend them to those folks as well as to the ones in this bill. So I was, and if you look at Subdivision 2 on enforcement, it says a person who violates this chapter. Well, this provision is in this chapter. So if it wasn't expiring, it would be stopped. I would almost recommend that you pick out what you want and restate it in this section rather than reviving the statute, not knowing, what reach that has and what legislative scheme it interferes with, and then
just apply it to this
action rather than such a complicated approach.
Just apply it to folks that are participating in this article of conduct.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would decide on whatever it is you wanted as sanctions, state them in the bill in that section, and be done with it.
Sure.
Rather than revise
this
statute.
Okay.
That's very broad.
That might make sense. And I think Mr. Elock might have looked at that, but it was late
I put it that way at first.
Late in the day.
It's actually taking the language here and just putting it in the bill. That's certainly an option.
I would recommend you not take all of it because I think it was designed for local competition violations. And this is a situation we've already found that there's competition.
Mm-hmm.
And it's somewhat self-regulating for that. It's a class of people who we've already decided are subject to competition.
So perhaps we could, Mr. Fuller, as well, just revert back to the, what was that other statute, 081 or something? That just allows somebody to petition the PUC for an order?
Right, and they could order them to...
They could order them to raise their prices or cease and desist or do lots of things.
Well, not lots.
Well, I mean, things that would get them back in line with the marketplace.
And if you want stricter penalties, Mr. Chairman, just put them in the way you want them rather than through
the
reference.
Sure, sure. Mr. Beard, what do you think?
I'm thinking that we could leave a lot of those tools out and just have a penalty that applies to this civilly, say between 100 and, I'm just picking a number out of the air, $100 and $5,000 a day if the commission thinks they need to do that.
Yeah.
Mindful of the fact that it goes to the state treasury and not to the aggrieved party. But if they can order corrective action, we might have to get some people's attention for penalties. So I don't know what are my colleagues think. Say 105.
Well,
I'm with that in, or are we making up something dangerous on the fly here?
Mr. Chair, Dan Lichtschultz on behalf of Competitive Local Exchange Carriers. If you would just indulge me for a moment. The key provision is actually 237.462, because that's the provision specifically designed, as Mr. Fuller said, for anti-competitive acts. Well, predatory pricing is precisely that. It's an anti-competitive act. We're not looking necessarily for the full arsenal under 461. That clearly has a lot of things in it. But the ability for the commission to issue administrative penalties for intentional violations of a provision that's intended to prohibit anti-competitive conduct is precisely what this bill needs in our view. So if you were looking to try to parse this out and limit it, we would strongly recommend that you focus on 237.462. And if you're inclined to do that in lieu of 461, at least from our perspective, that would be the best approach.
Mr. Chairman,
thank you.
What he said.
No, seriously.
Mr. Fulber raised a question that I think we need to fully understand. if these sections of statute were going to expire by our previous legislature, maybe we should understand why they were going to expire before we extend. 462 yeah. apparently is to expire.
Well, I like the idea of just rewriting them into this section of this statute, and we can just lift the
same penalties, right?
Okay. Can't we, Mr. Ford?
Just take 462 and put it in this article 7.
Mr. Chairman, let me get caught up, and maybe what I need to do is review 237.462 before we get too much farther along with Representative Beard's motion. And just for the record, the provision that I had been referred to was section 325D.56. Which in subdivision 2 provides criminal penalties, and that's for actions in that are in restraint of trade. The question would be whether the predatory pricing fits into that the set of definitions with respect to restraint of trade, and I can see, you know, arguments that it does. So that's one of the issues with respect to are there enough penalties in place already. But Mr. Chairman, let's take a look at the language of 462 as part of this. I know that members have already looked at that. I just have to catch up with that.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, I guess I want to ask Senator Kelly a question because I haven't really looked at that 325. Does that, who would enforce that? Would that be just a county attorney or the attorney general? I think it does make sense to have some penalties that are available to the Public Utilities Commission.
It seems to be where we're directing these folks to take their complaints.
Mm-hmm.
The Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, doing a quick review, anybody who is harmed by it can bring an action and recover treble damages, and then there's a provision for injunctive relief, presumably available to somebody who's been harmed by it, and then the Attorney General can investigate on finding reasonable cause, can institute an action on behalf of the state of Minnesota.
That'd be in the courts, presumably?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think that would be right.
So it's a, Mr. Chair, so it's a private right of action or an attorney general initiated?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Senator Anderson, and it's getting late. The civil penalties presumably could be sought by the Attorney General in an action, and then in the criminal penalty, I suppose a county attorney or the AG could institute the criminal penalty.
So the argument for keeping 462, Senator Anderson, would be, and the other statute 081 or whatever it was, would be a measure to go to the PUC and not have to go through the court system, mm-hmm. which I suppose you could argue the PUC is the ones who kind of have a continuous reign or continuous oversight on these issues.
Mr. Chair, I do have one. I'm trying to find Section 3 of this amendment, and I don't think there is one. Am I missing something here?
Mr. Chair, I can speak to that. I think in line 13 it says renumber the succeeding session. I think that's where the 3 is supposed to be kind of presumed, assumed or something.
That's correct. The paragraphs referring to the Public Utility Commission responsibilities would be renumbered Section 3.
All right.
So, Representative Beard has moved this for discussion. This essentially is the one amendment that's got everything in it that you had talked about.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Senator Anderson?
we've had a lot of discussion about this percentage issue, and I've had some concerns about that as well, and about what's the magic number.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also had some conversations since this passed the Senate floor about some other options, and I wonder if Representative Beard might find it more useful to just strike the third section here that allows the commission to determine competitiveness based on some magic number. And that's on page 11.
Subdivision 3?
Yeah, subdivision 3, and then the paragraph 3 above that. And so then you would just be limiting, you would declare a competitive area to be the metropolitan area as well as any city of the first class.
Okay, drop kind of the rural areas. First class, does that include St. Cloud and Rochester?
That includes Duluth and Minneapolis-St. Paul. So you can define it however you wanted.
Yep.
Which cities?
The net effect would be the same if we did it, and yes, I'd be amenable to that, because I believe that I heard the number 50% thrown around in the Twin City area. I don't know about Duluth, but that certainly would strike some of us as being well over the 20% threshold, which is pretty low to me. So,
and then just get rid of the whole 20%, 30%, whatever. We don't have to sit and measure loss. What about... It seems to me St. Cloud and Rochester should be included in those size cities, but what do you think of that?
Let's see.
Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, does anyone know, there's probably someone in the room that knows, what the...
population?
Well, what the percentage is of business right now? I mean, is there somebody that...
Maybe before we get to that, I think the overarching concern I have in this is that in areas where competition is thriving and rather healthy, and it seems appropriate that Quest have some ability to begin to compete against parameters that we've just been discussing. But in the rest of the state, I don't know that we want to subject our CLEC activity to that kind of competition just yet. So in the Rochester, St. Cloud, Main Toledo area, so on and so forth. Let's just hold off on
hold
that
up.
A little while. Okay. That's what I'm thinking.
So let's, Senator Kelly, would that be all right with you? If we,
Mr. Chairman,
narrowing this?
I think Senator Anderson has a good suggestion. I'm glad to hear that Representative Beard is amenable to looking at it. And you know, I know that in, I'm less clear about Rochester, but I do know that in St. Cloud, there are true facilities-based competitors who are providing voice service as well as video and data. So so maybe St. Cloud, as you suggested, Mr. Chairman, would be appropriate. But if we want to get somebody to talk about that, that might be a good idea, too.
Can we promote them to a city of the first class?
Well,
there might be a few other statutes.
Mr. Chairman, that might be like that, you know, Representative Beard's other suggestion.
We may not want to just carte blanche put them in that category. We could just say first class, and, including St. Cloud.
Unintended consequences.
Well, you know, Mr. Chairman, if we did go down this line, I think we would just name the cities.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Now, when we would say St. Cloud, that would just be city St. Cloud proper. It wouldn't mean Sauk Rapids or Sartell or...
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be correct.
Okay. Well, I don't know. How much debate do we need on this, guys? Anybody got a burning...
I can support this.
Senator Gaither?
Yeah, I can support that.
Support
Class
and St. Cloud?
Class and St. Cloud.
Senator Gaither, let's just move that amendment, huh?
Right.
Mr. Fuller or Eloff, would you want to just state what would be a proper amendment here?
Why don't you go ahead, John?
Mr. Chairman, as I heard it, you are moving to on page 11 of the unofficial endorsement, which is where strike after line on line 21 after area, insert the word or. Line 22, delete the semicolon, delete or, insert a period. Delete lines 23 and 24. Delete subdivision 3, which is lines 25, 32. And I would assume, I don't think it appears anywhere else in the section.
St. Cloud.
And then I wasn't clear about the city of St. Cloud, Mr. Chairman. What's right?
Mr. Chairman, on that one, I think on line 22, in addition to the change that Mr. Fuller described, we would say, instead of city of the first class, we would say in Duluth or St. Cloud.
Mm. Would we need to include the metro area?
That's on line 20, I think, before first class.
I was just checking to make sure you all know.
Any questions on this?
I'm okay with this. I can support this.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passes.
We've amended the amendment.
We've amended the amendment.
So line 3 is history.
What else we need to amend on that? I guess we've got to run in and check in the House. But the other thing is members, under the rules, we have to have a two-thirds or two out of three vote on both sides to extend it for an hour after midnight if we want to try to go and just wrap this up. What's people's prerogative? So I think we could maybe get it done in an hour. Mr. Chair, I'd be okay with that. Senator Gaither?
Mr. Chair, I've had half a pot of Jamaican me crazy coffee, so I'm good.
You're good.
Senator Kelly, is that all right? Mr. Chairman, I think we have a chance of trying to get it done, so I support doing that.
Okay. Senator, Chair will move that we, under the rules, extend the conference committee an hour to 1 a.m. All those in favor, I say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Let's see. What else is this?
Mr. Chairman, we should, I need to check in the House and come back.
Let's not recess. Senator Kelly, you take the gavel and delegate it when I come back. And if you want to just move the discussion so if we can narrow.
Well, actually, Mr. Chairman, looks like we're going to lose all three members on the House side. So why don't we recess for say 20 minutes till 12:15?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Recess for 12:15.
All right.
Very good. How's the cell phone stuff?
I think Wei's still thinking about it.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Let's do it a little bit right back.
I hear you.
We did get permission to come back, but if they call a vote, we might have to just up and run. So, Representative Bearden.
We're still talking about my proposal, or my amendment that's on the table here.
Yeah, let's roll through that.
First of all, I don't know if it's probably necessary or how you want to handle this, but Senator Anderson's suggestion on my line 3, 20 to 30, I just accept that as a friendly amendment if you want to avoid the vote on that, if that's okay with everyone.
We did vote on it.
We did. Yeah. Well, you're way ahead of me.
Done.
Okay. And furthermore, back to the business about the provisions on line 6 and 7 about violations.
Mm-hmm.
I tripped across some further information that I think all of us should hear from someone who was actually a party to why the sunset was written. So I'd like to ask either Mr. Mike Bull or Mr. Ed Garvey to come up to the microphone here and tell us why that fence was built before we rebuild it again. And I think it would be very helpful.
Well, we're going to need to make it real quick. That's assuming we want to make this those provisions part of this.
Now I'm going to encourage
Mr. Bolt.
Mr. Garvey?
Mr. Garvey.
He's coming with a big book.
We're going to need it to be real quick.
Mr. Grove, you understand, Mr. Chairman, if I may, the discussion about why, first of all, why there's a sunset in the thing, and what other actions would be if we extended the sunset in there and had 460.
461,
4462. 462 in particular apply here as a method of recourse for people who feel they've been aggrieved.
Mr. Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Edward Garvey, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Commerce. At the time of 237.462 was adopted, I was actually chairman of the Public Utilities Commission. And what we were finding was that we at the Public Utilities Commission didn't necessarily have the necessary tools in order to police the budding marketplace. There was actually a wave across the country to give Public Utility Commissions administrative penalty authority. We pursued those, and those were adopted and in 237.462. But that was actually a pretty big leap that the legislature did give the commission. And so therefore they, like Representative Beard, your own thought is I'm sort of setting a little sort of look back from the legislature's point of view. They said, we're going to sunset this in a while to see how these played out. And so they gave, the legislature gave the commission the authority, but they said, we want to take a look at it, and we want, this isn't a perpetual authority. And so that's why the sunset was there, and that's why this provision was adopted when it was.
So on this issue, I just need to find out where people are thinking. If we extended this sunset, is that something people would be comfortable or willing to, interested in doing, or is this going to just prolong the debate too long tonight?
Mr. Chairman, I actually had a question for Mr. Garvey before he fled the scene, because it falls our happy lot to have the sunset discovered on our watch here tonight. Mr. Garvey, you've been around the PUC since this was established. In your humble opinion, do you think it's worked well? Is it giving you what you need, or is it something that is so persnickety we really should take it back to civil law or something?
Mr. Chairman, members of the Congress Committee, the provision is arguably a useful tool in the commission's quiver, but it is a has been a very awkwardly used tool and relatively rarely used. And so, I mean, it's one of those kind of tools you want to have the tool, but boy, you know, it's certainly one that you hope you don't have to use very often, and when you do use it, it has turned into sort of its own less efficient mess than perhaps some of the other tools that the commission has.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Kelly.
Chairman, one possible way of avoiding doing harm without making too abrupt a decision would be to incorporate an extension of, along with incorporating a reference to the deregulatory section into 462, would be to extend the sunset until June 30th, 2005.
Just through next year's
session. Just to provide an opportunity to have somebody introduce a bill and have a full debate next session. With respect, we avoid losing the enforcement capacity during the first half of 05, and
because we'd lose it if we don't extend it next year.
And Mr. Chair, are you saying for this new section of law as well as for the previous section of law, for both, it would expire?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, if I was picking up on the debate well enough earlier, 462 only applies to specified sections of Chapter 237. So we would have to add that list of specified sections, the language we're adding in Article 7.
Article.
Then in addition, amend the sunset language to change it to June 30th, 2005.
So in effect, if we let it sunset next year, when we reference back to that in this language, there's just not going to be any
statute to enforce after next June if the legislature does nothing. I like that better. I think it's easier. We come back and people say, wait a minute, a five-year extension is easier to argue 6 months.
I don't want to.
I would agree. I think there could be consensus on that. Let's. How complicated of an amendment is that?
It's actually not too bad.
Mr. Eloff, you want to?
I don't think.
You want to just work on that while we move on, and we'll come right back and vote on that? Or do you think it's ready now?
It sounds like we're referencing the entire 462 and inserting in what is going to be 237.411 in, I believe it's subdivision 1, making violations of this subject to those provisions.
And that sunset would only extend to 2005.
And, Mr. Chairman, I'll leave it to Mr. Eloff and Mr. Fuller about where to handle it, whether to reference .462 in Article 7 or alternatively just amend .4, the list of things to which it applies in .462 to include a violation of 237.411, subdivision 5.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Anderson.
If I might, I would, this is probably the difficulty in drafting would, tonight, would lead to a statute that is easier to read in the future. And I guess I'm always in favor of making the statutes read themselves without having to cross-reference. So I think it just makes them more usable for those who are affected. So
how would you prefer?
I would rather keep the reference to 462 in this section as well. Yeah. It might make it a little more complicated tonight.
Mr. Chair, somewhere along the way did we lose 461? No, we had a test fire said 462. We definitely had to stay, but was there a reason we dropped 461 from the discussion? And if not, I would encourage us to extend that, to do the legislature a favor and extend that to June 30th of next summer also. Then we can just somewhat...
You lost your floor.
Well, Mr. Chairman, looking at subdivision 1 of 461, it says, this chapter may be enforced by any other combination of criminal... It looks like it picks it up already.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fuller, the question is about the sunset. Is there a sunset on 461 as well?
And I believe it is.
It's just a subdivision. It was a dual question. That was the second half of my question.
Just sort of the subdivisions, Mr. Chairman.
So how can we work on that amendment right now? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I would recommend that you just give us instructions to include in the Conference Committee report.
Okay.
Language extending the sunset, was it June 30th?
June 30th.
And then to make violations of...
Force...
The new statute, 237.411, subject to those sections. Timely done in Conference, we just give
okay. We need to vote on that? Okay. Well,
Mr. Chair, please, just so we're clear, that my original motion on line 7 included 237.461 and 462. Is there a reason we stopped talking about 461? Okay. They're both included here, and we just...
In the sunset extension on 461 and 462, staff will extend them until June 30th, 2005.
Great.
And cross-reference the statutes. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign.
Motion carries. Mr. Chair?
Senator Gate, not a problem. Are we finished with that section at this point?
Article 7, Mr. Chairman. And the only other thing is in line 16 where it says the provisions of this section expire August 1st, I really would like that to say the provisions of this article. Just so we're clear, this is Article 7 as a five-year sunset.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, given the other changes that we've made to this section, I would oppose having a sunset on it. I think that we've reached some good compromises with respect to the effects of the provision and imposing some penalties, and so I think in terms of sort of the give and take, the good give and take we've had so far, I would hope that we could leave out the sunset on this provision in any event.
Representative Beard?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may proceed gently just for a moment here. Again, I'd just like to remind us that this section is a total surprise to us on the House side. We're going to have to sell this on the floor as it is. And Grandpa used to say, if it's a good deal today, it'll be a good deal tomorrow. And I'd like to say, I think that this is going to work out just fine. But if it works out just fine this summer and next summer, it surely will work out just fine all the way to 2009. And whoever follows me in this seat, I trust them to recognize a good deal when they see it and lift the sunsets. So I don't see how it's an onerous thing. I see that it could be a safety backup in case the thing does turn into a train wreck for some unforeseen reason. There is at least some sort of a bumper at the end of the road to call us up, call us to account on the deal. So I'm confident that the provisions of Article 7 are going to accomplish what Senator Kelly's hoping for. And I'm appreciative for the comfort language on the floor of the House to tell folks that there's a safe trail city that isn't working. Well, I guess that's just kind of...
I would have similar feelings, but I don't know what Senator Anderson or Gaither, do you have feelings one way or the other?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that the Senate is as enamored of sunsets as the House seems to be. We've seen them in a number of bills. And,
it's called full employment for the legislature.
Well, there'll be somebody here. They can introduce a bill just as easily as having a sunset take effect. So I guess I'm not. I think that with the change that I suggested, I think that we've really gone even further, perhaps, than you were trying to do in compromise on this. Maybe if I could be so bold as to say that this maybe took your compromise even further in the other sections of the amendment, of the article.
Well,
so maybe
that's assuming we can sell this. We just haven't had discussion on it, so that it gives me trepidation. We've got another issue we're coming right back to, which is opt-in and opt-out. And, I don't know what the resolution of that is, but I can assure you any opt-in is going to be pulling teeth on the House floor.
Mr. Chair, in the spirit of compromise, if that's what is one of the components that's critical for your fellow members in the House to enact this legislation, I would be able to support that. Again, I do share Senator Kelly's and Senator Anderson's, I don't want to say lack of concern, but opinion on the matter. And so, but again, the spirit of compromise, if that's what it would take to move this thing forward in combination with some other issues that we're about to address, I'd be willing to back the yes.
Mr. Chairman, maybe so we don't get accused of rolling over too easily, maybe I could talk Representative Beard into a 6-year sunset rather than a 5-year sunset, and then I could support it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, give me just a moment so I don't feel like I'm caving in too quickly.
The record should show thoughtful consideration and
deliberation.
It is 4:40 a.m.
Should we let's look at 6 years sunset on that provision, 2010 August 1st? Is that what you're proposing, Senator Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. With that, all those in favor of a what is that? This article would sunset on August 1st, 2010. Say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Gaither.
If we're finished with that section, in the interest of time, you referenced earlier the opt-in situation that we were talking about, and the Article 4 issue with cable. In the interest of time, I will try to get right to the point. One of the ways, reasons that we're here today is I believe that people have compromised and that we have taken on some difficult things up to this point, and that not always been easy for any of the participants here. Given the fact that the cable groups have come forward and said that they, I'm going to believe them at their word, have made efforts in trying to resolve the differences between the two various points of view, and the fact that they have not, and that we are up against the deadline as well, I would like to propose a possible compromise. And the compromise would be that we would remove Article 4 in its entirety. And I'm not sure I'm making the proper motion, but just as a discussion point. And then and for consideration of that, leave the remaining opt-in language in the bill as it is currently written. So we've got a
Senate article.
Yes. That would be the premise of potential compromise here in conjunction with what the stakeholders have done up to this point as well. In that spirit.
Senator Gaither, I got two thoughts. One, I want to review just the Senate language quickly on the side here once we get looking at that. I think we could consider that or something close to that. I got two provisions. One, we're back to a sunset concept. How about a sunset in 2 years on this provision? If we find it really onerous, we can revisit it. If it's working real well, we extend it. And I want to bring one more thing into the discussion under Article 1. The requirement of all the companies to notify people of the direct free assistance credit on their bills. As the author of that language, I don't care to make that much of a burden on the companies, and I would like those two to come out if we're going to take the opt-in language, but then drop the Article 4. But I guess I'll lay that on the table for discussion.
Mr. Chair, just for clarification, when you said you'd like those two to come out, do you mean the entire Article 1?
No. Just the difference. Well, the House, I believe, we should look at the person language versus the provider.
Exchange.
Just because that was written, the way the Senate passes, the way I drafted it originally, it came to our attention afterwards that we should just put person because it include, there wouldn't be anybody that could wiggle out of the definition. I think the AG offered that to us, or somebody did, and or the companies or somebody. The Senate added some language about notifying everybody of it. Frankly, I think most people know when they get bad information they can call, but I think to make them put it on every month's bill gets to be some cost, and I like the policy, but I wasn't doing it with the intention of adding a monthly cost to the companies. But so no, not the provision at all, just that last part of the language.
Mr. Chair, does a person include a corporation?
Yes.
A corporation is not a person, but a person is a corporation?
No, I think it's the other way around. A corporation, I believe, is a... Senator Kelly, you correct me. A corporation is a person, just not a natural person.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to correct what I think was a misunderstanding of the Senate language. Doesn't require a monthly notice. The notice has to be given to a new customer within 45 days of commencing service, and then once a year after that. During the discussion process with respect to this, at one point it was suggested that there be a separate notice and on a separate document, and that was deleted. So what I've been told by the providers is that they will annually print a notice on the bill, and that though that is some extra expense, it's not an excessive extra expense, and it's one that they could accomplish without changing their systems very drastically. So that was the reason that it was included in
this. How about a compromise, Sir Senator Kelly? How about we go with the first notice within 45 days, and that likely that would come out with their package when people sign up, and I mean, that'll be the notice.
Mr. Chairman, let me think about that, because that wasn't the, you know, I think Senator Gator was making an effort to get us to a prompt resolution, and it got more complex. In response. So,
Mr. Chair.
So there were multiple pieces of what the chair laid on the table.
Do I understand the Senate position is that when you sign a new service, a notification comes in 45 days, then once a year they're notified?
They have to re-notify that.
Well, Mr. Chair, that doesn't strike me as particularly onerous for the company.
I want it on my camera.
Now that I got what I want, I don't care what it's not.
Just I adjourned this meeting.
No. Once a year, it doesn't.
Well, we always add these things one at a time, and that's what companies. But you've been in business longer than I have, Representative Beard, so that's just, I guess, my concern. We don't have a lot of time for debate on it. I don't know. Do the companies, do you guys have an annual? Anybody from the companies just answer out of the crowd? Do you have an annual notice you send out usually with rules and regulations and rights anyways?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chairman, we do. It's called the Annual Bill of Rights for Customers.
Annual Bill of Rights, and you just add it in there?
Right, and when we spoke to Senator Kelly, it was our request that we be allowed to include this notice in that Bill of Rights on the bill itself as a message.
And you send that type of thing out when someone signs up for service, too?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
And you're from?
From Frontier Citizen.
Frontier Citizen. But that's all phone companies primarily do that?
More
now. Yes. Okay. Well, you guys just poured more water on the campfire. What else can I bargain? No. Okay, let's get back to the opt-in, opt-out language. We look at the Senate language, essentially, is what you're talking, Senator Gates.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
I propose a 2-year sunset on that. We strike number 4. Critical 4.
Senators Kelly and Anderson. Oops, sorry.
I'm sorry.
There's, a provision request to put a 2-year opt-in on the
2-year sunset.
The 2-year sunset on the opt-in.
The opt-in.
Well,
Mr. Chair, in the Senate, we tend to think in 4-year increments rather than 2-year
increments. Just see a first technical thing.
So you're talking 09? No, 08. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. 07?
07?
That's only 3 years.
December 31st, 07?
I kind of, Mr. Chair, if we do have sunsets, I like them to be sort of right at the beginning or the end of a legislative session so that somebody can do something about them.
Yeah.
If they care to.
So like
accidentally finding them.
So like a June 30th or August 1st, which is when. August 1st is a natural because that's when all laws go in and out.
Sure.
That makes sense.
So. That would be August 1st, 2008.
It's 4 now. 5, 6. How about 7? That's 3 years.
It's almost August. It's summer.
I know. That's over 3 years. I want to just take 2 minutes. I want to just review this language quick, if that's all right.
Like Joe, if you want to.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vanderveer is here, and we've been trying to be respectful of the author's concerns. Representative Vanderveer, part of the deal we're describing here is a potential 4-year sunset. Do you have a reaction to that?
Not, Mr. Chair, Senator Kelly, not the sunset, but the
opt-in. The section on the House, this would be the Senate, page or line 30, page 10. If the customer does not affirmatively opt-in to accept the proposed substantive change in the original contract, terms shall apply. I think that to provide some flexibility to the industry, we might want to add something to the effect that for a minimum of 60 days at the customer's option. Otherwise, I think you're saying that essentially they can't change the contracts at all.
Mr. Fuller, is that your read on this?
Hmm.
Let me just read it out loud, and I'll think that if the customer does not firmly opt in to accept the proposed substantive change, then the original contract terms shall apply. The issue I see with that is I don't see an issue in the sense that if he doesn't opt in, I mean, if you don't have an opt in, the contract stays the way it was. So, if your manager could restate his concern. What again?
Mr. Chair, what the concern is that if we're going to take the approach that once the provider gives you a 2-year contract, then they can't unilaterally change it, then that would make sense. But I think we wanted to avoid that because of the fluctuating nature of the industry and to allow them as much flexibility as possible and still, protect the customer. If what you do here is say that then the terms continue, if they're unable to provide that for some reason, if something's happened where they can no longer provide some facet of that service and we can't think of every facet of it here today, then you're saying that they still have to offer it. Let's see what I'm...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vanderveer, again, I think I see the issue here. That when the consumer goes in and gets a 2-year contract, the company is negotiating for the 2-year contract because they want stability in the customer base.
Right.
And then a year goes by and something happens and the company proposes to change the contract in a way that's adverse to the customer, like by extending the term. Okay. The customer has still got a 1-year contract with the company. So if the customer does not opt into the change, the customer should be entitled to continue on the 1-year contract.
An existing contract.
So I'm having trouble with us putting into statute some minimum term, because then at the end of that contract term, obviously the company can change, but before that, the company shouldn't be able to change.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
You're correct, but I'm wondering, I know you're not taking testimony, but if you might want to hear, if someone from the industry might want to re-explain what I'm saying. You're correct. Normally, if you have a contract for a year, and I have one with you, I can't call you up and say I'm changing it, and... But we were persuaded that there are legitimate reasons that they would have to do that. And the effect, I think, of the way the bill is written would prevent that. And I'm not sure if I'm explaining it correctly or not, but the impact of what you're doing is saying what you just said, that if you got a 2-year contract, you can't really change it unless the customer agrees. And that... they felt could, in the end, be detrimental to the consumer because it takes away a lot of flexibility for the providers. And it's going to affect the types of contracts that are offered and could end up hurting people or hurting the consumer. But if that's, you know, what you want to do, I can't. Do you understand? Does anyone want to come up here and explain that?
Do we have somebody from the...
And do it better?
Wireless cell phone industry that wants to give this a shot?
Okay. I don't care.
Say in a minute.
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Kelly, for all of us, actually, for discussion here, the big concern isn't that I'm going to get to find out one day to pick up my cell phone that it doesn't work, which it doesn't sometimes anyhow, the darn thing, but because they shut my contract or I didn't opt in or something like that. That's not the issue here. The issue is when all of a sudden I had a two-year contract and I'm coming to the end of that term and find out that because I monkeyed with my program 6 months ago, I've got a new two-year contract. I didn't know that. So now I want to change my provider, and I find out I'm locked into this contract, and so now I'm in a snit with my provider. And they report it to the credit bureau if I just say, fine, take your phone back and stop paying the bill. It's now becoming a credit report because there's been this lack of clarity that somehow my contract has been extended. I think this is, you know, if it's just a matter of they turn off your voicemail or something, well, that's pesky. But we can work those things out. But the problem is there's credit reporting stuff with this that affects the consumer. So I'm going to take the consumer side here for a moment. This, I think, is the essence of what we're trying to get to here. Consumer protection isn't life and limb. It's the aggravation of applying for a car loan, and they say, whoa, you haven't paid your cellular bill for 3 years because you turned your phone in or something like that. That's what we're trying to get here. Am I kind of nailing the crux of the essence of this whole thing?
Mr. Chairman,
so opting in and opting out really to me is almost a secondary issue.
And Mr. Chairman,
Senator Kelly,
Representative Beard's comments were helpful. What I'm wondering is whether the change that Representative Vanderveer described was maybe too compact. I mean, I kind of get where you're pointed, but it isn't clear enough about what the consumer's choices are in that situation. Because in a sense, what you're, you know, to use Representative Beard's example, is you come up to within 30 days of the end of what you thought was your contract, and then you realize it's been extended. You don't. You need some time to get an alternative contract, so you want the consumer to be able to extend that. But you don't need the extension if the consumer discovers this change earlier.
Mr. Chairman, to that point, exactly. If somehow this notification process that we're struggling with here is so clear that when I monkey with that program and add a feature, I'm clearly notified that, hey, you are extending your program for another 2 years, so be advised here, bucko. Now, whether that's by me signing a note and sending it in, yes, I want it, or they send me something in the opt-in, opt-out, I think that's the discussion, is the mechanism of how we make this consumer sit up and pay attention and know that his contract terms are being changed. And I'm thinking just in length of terms, because that's where I run up against it before, and I think Brother Vanderveer did too, but there might be other things which just don't strike me as, if they don't hit the credit bureau, they just strike me as pesky and don't rise to the level of legislative action. When they start monkeying with somebody's credit rating, that's why we're talking about it here today, because that is, I think, important enough for us to be working with.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Opt in, opt out for this boy, it's a horse apiece, actually.
Representative Vanderveer.
Whether the industry cares or not, Senator Kelly, I think we would be making a mistake to not allow them any flexibility with regards to the contract. I think that would be bad for us and could potentially harm the consumers in the long run in the market.
But Representative Vanderveer, do you have language that we need to look at?
Mr. Chair, I do, but Senator Kelly maybe is considering whether it is complete enough. Is that?
I think, Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
I understood Representative Vanderveer to be proposing that at the end of line 32 on page 10, for 60 days at the customer's option. And you know, my concern is that if the original contract was for, you know, would have lasted for another 90 days, we have just shortened the serve. Contract, and we didn't necessarily help the customer in that by saying for 60 days, because we're just sort of setting the time limit. So it's almost like if we've got a concern around this, it needs a new sentence that lays out the customer's choices.
On this issue, do you think Mr. Fuller or Mr. Eloff can work with Ray quickly? And you think work it up quick?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I kind of get it, but I think we're going to run out of time. My concern is that we'll run out of time, especially since we don't, I mean, we're trying to reflect some industry approach to this. We don't have somebody here to.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would agree. Let's let it. We could probably let it go.
That's why we got a sunset on this thing.
Yeah, with the sunset.
If it doesn't work, we will be revisiting it. There's one other in my review with it. There was just a couple areas that I think are pretty technical, but I would just like to propose them. The part about the opt-in and being in writing, I have language, Mr. Eloff, if you have it ready to hand out.
Yes.
I had looked at this earlier. I would just propose, rather than just be in writing, that we do similar to what we did with the third-party billing that passed earlier and allow it to be oral or electronic. And my basis initially of wanting this is myself, I personally don't care to have writing. I'd like to be able to pick up the phone and get it accomplished, myself. So if people would be amenable to at least adding those as three ways that they could get it verified, that would be what I would propose.
Mr. Chair, I see that the oral authorization, somebody's crossed off.
The third party.
Verified by an independent third party verifier. It just says it has to be reported, and you're incorporating that.
Yeah.
But then the next sentence says this verification is valid only if the independent third
That's
party.
That's crossed off too, or should be.
On. That should be crossed off too.
Sorry.
So recorded.
Basically, when I call my cell phone company now.
I mean, what if they...
They record my conversation with them, and then they read it back and say, so we're adding, on your cell phone, we're going up to 1,000 minutes instead of 800 minutes, and it's going to be $89 a month or whatever it is. And then I just say yes, and, I mean, that conversation is recorded. They mark the computer. If there was ever a dispute, they can pull the tapes up and say, well...
Okay,
here's what it said.
Mr. Chair, that's what I'm wondering, if it's, you know, recorded or if it's recorded and maintained in some form.
Oh, I see.
So that, you know, just, yeah, that it can be verified at a future date.
Further go on to say that they got to be maintained records?
No, it doesn't.
Doesn't it? Maybe we amend that. But
that would
record it on 19.
It does say under number 3, within 48 hours of receiving the customer's authorization, the provider must send the customer via email a notice of verification confirming the authorization.
That's for
the
email?
If they opt in via email.
I'm sorry.
So, point well taken, Senator Anderson. Maybe we should add the word recorded and stored by the company.
For length of the contract.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Kelly,
here's my concern. Senator Gaither had a proposal to a relatively simple proposal that to delete Article 4 and accept the Senate language on Article 6. And then we got into a discussion of the directory assistance, and then we have the sunset, and then we have the notification language, all of which may be okay, but we haven't had a time to piece it all together. So, you know, I don't know that we're opposed. I just don't feel comfortable leaping on this with 0 minutes left this evening. So I think we're really close, Mr. Chairman. I, you know, if we had another half hour to work on it, but I don't think we do. So I think we just need to look at how all these pieces fit together. Senator Gaither had this conversation on the floor about all the complexity of all the moving pieces, and this proposed amendment, a resolution has developed multiple moving pieces that we need to sort out.
Well, I've tried to keep it simple, similar to the language we've already passed this year, but I hear what you're saying. Would there be a simpler way to add the oral part to it and cut the internet out and just...
Mr. Chairman, that's the part I don't know. I recognize this language, but I haven't had the opportunity to fit it in and make sure it fits with this, especially since the wireless. I've managed to bone up on the wireless bill, but it was Senator Bachman's originally, and so I'm not quite as clear on how this piece fits into it.
And a fine piece of legislation it was.
Well, let's. What I'm hearing is we need to let's move on what we've kind of agreed on. If there's a way you can figure out how to do the oral part in a short period of time, Mr. Fuller or Mr. Eloff, that would be the most important to me. Keeping it simple, but. Given what Representative Gaither has said, let's move on those motions and just circle right back to this if there's any opportunity to do it. What I understand is we would delete Article 4, incorporate Article, what's the cell?
Article 6.
Incorporate the Senate language in Article 6 with the addition of a sunset on April or August 1st, 2007, and let's vote on that, and then move right back. All those in any discussion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I thought we were working on a 4-year sunset.
Well, it was 2, and then
40,
and actually, given the questions Representative Vandergrift raised and all that, I think the shorter the better, just so we review this sooner than later if there's problems with it. But
okay.
Representative Gaither.
Well, that's okay. Just clearing my throat. Ready to vote yes. Oh, I didn't say that.
Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. I guess we're down to just the other provisions that we think are similar. Any way to go oral on that, Mr. Fuller?
Article 2 and 3 from the House file.
Okay. I'll move that. Okay, Chair will move adoption of Articles 2 and 3 from the Senate bill, House bill. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Mr. Fuller.
And the Senate has Article 3 obsolete rules.
Oh, and we had that in ours. I think we dropped it off accidentally. Is that the telecom rules? Yeah, Senator Kelly will move the adoption of the Senate language on Article 3. Correct? Article 3?
Correct.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair? I think the only article we haven't really talked about is Article 5. Mm-hmm. That's the expanded calling areas.
Oh, sure.
There are differences between the Senate version and the House version, and we haven't talked about this at all. I'm just going to throw this out. For Article 5, what would be the Senate's position on adopting the House language on the first part of Article 5, the pertains to independent telephone companies as opposed to the Senate language pertains to telephone companies on page 6, I believe.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, in the discussion on this, the Senate actually liked the concept that the small telephone companies were proposing and felt that it was a good enough concept about negotiating these interconnection agreements and voluntary extended area service arrangements that we didn't see a downside to making it available to all telephone companies. Nobody said anything against that idea, that this was a good idea and ought to apply to all telephone companies. I don't know if there's an advantage to preserving it to just small telephone companies, because there are a few larger companies that serve rural customers, and this should benefit rural customers regardless of the size of the provider.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Beard?
Maybe this question is for you. Was the House language a function of the particular lobbyist that brought us the bill?
I don't.
Notice those things happen from time.
It's amazing how they do, but I don't know that.
But I do have the House language here someplace.
Tori, maybe cool. You know that. Was this language in Article 5, and I don't know where this was in the House.
What's that, Mike? Yeah. Do you know anything about it, Mike?
Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Beard has a good point. My recollection is that this was an initiative of small independent telephone companies, and they were trying to get flexibility for themselves. And when we saw it, we said this is a good thing for everybody. And
nobody
has said nay.
That's what I thought. So what is the dispute on? How many article sections are there in this article? You asked about Section 1.
There's two different, on the comparison, the side-by-side sheet, there's two changes. The first one is the one we talked about. The second one, the House didn't have the provision. The Senate has language that says requires public disclosure of prices, terms, and conditions and agreements to terminate expanded calling traffic and allows other carriers to adopt them for similar services provided in those exchanges. And I don't have a problem with that. I was just curious.
What's the difference on the first one?
The first one, the language on the side-by-side is the House language pertains to independent telephone companies under 50,000 subscribers.
And it's any call company.
Right.
What's your concern? Do you like the Senate language or the House language?
I like a nice combination of the two.
All right.
Somebody move something.
I'm trying to, actually the Senate language is, I think, fine with me, but Representative Beard, what do you think?
I like Senate language too. It's so inclusive.
What about your campfire?
I'm feeling very lonely here.
Sorry.
Corey, did you notice Beard's been hanging us both out here?
Senator Kelly, you want to move the Senate language? With respect to the With respect to the issue of which companies can engage in this, I'll move the Senate language
for
all telephone companies.
Senator Kelly moves that amendment to approve the Senate language on the first part of Article 5.
I did not.
Senator Kelly made the motion.
Senator Kelly, any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Motion carries. Second part, just briefly explain what that does, Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, that was language suggested by an inter-exchange carrier who's interested in being able to extend service more broadly and felt that if companies agreed on interconnection terms and prices and so forth for particular exchanges, that those terms and prices ought to be available to other carriers as well, as long as they were for technically similar services, that you couldn't get the same price for a different kind of service.
Okay.
And so it was a way of trying to be non-discriminatory and extending the options to more
providers or more providers. Okay. Anybody have any issues with that?
No.
Anybody in the audience? Anything? No.
I don't see any heads nodding.
Representative Beard, you want to move the Senate language?
I'd be delighted.
On the rest of the second part of Article 5?
I would.
Representative Beard moves the language. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Let me come back right to our Article 6. I have language I would just love to throw out and close this committee up in less than 2 minutes. Mr. Fuller, could you just read? Does that language work with you, that Mr. Elock?
I'll read it.
Okay,
if you don't mind.
Just tell them where.
This is on page 10, line 30. Let me read this sentence. What's in there currently says the change only becomes effective if the customer opts into the change by affirmatively accepting the change in writing prior to the proposed effective date. What we're proposing is adding to the end of that sentence, comma, or by oral authorization, which is recorded by the provider and maintained for the duration of the contract.
Yeah, that works.
Would that be simpler?
Whose campfire gets it?
I'll move it.
Senator Kelly, could we work with that?
Chairman, that makes sense to me.
Okay. Would you move the language?
Representative Beard looked like you wanted to.
Representative Beard, you finished the last
team
move.
Player here.
Rain on me. I'll move that language, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Beard moves the language, adding in the oral recorded authorization on page 10, line 30.
Yeah.
Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Motion
carries. So, I think with that, is there, Mr. Fuller or Mr. Ruoff, is there any parts we haven't covered? And
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fuller pointed out to me a technical change on in Article 6, page 10, line 36. This is the section that provides a provider with respect to a customer-initiated change. It says if the customer proposes to the provider any change in the terms of an existing contract, the provider must clearly disclose to the customer orally or electronically any change to the existing contract. And since what we're talking about above was any substantive change, Mr. Fuller thought it would be more consistent to insert the word
substantive
with respect to
any change.
Yes. Not doing that with respect to the customer's proposed change, but to the consequence of the proposed change arising from that. So it'd be line 36, before change, insert substantive.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson.
Just to then to clarify the end of that sentence, because this is a long sentence, but I guess I'll read it. If the customer proposes to the provider any change in the terms of an existing contract, the provider must clearly disclose to the customer orally or electronically any substantive change, right? That's mm-hmm. So the existing contract terms that would result from the customer's proposed change, including but not limited to contract duration and price. So where we say contract duration and price, we're talking about the first change.
We're talking about the substantive change.
So that would be modifying contract duration and price. I mean, where it says contract duration and price, we're not talking about, that's not the customer's proposed change.
Right.
That's the provider's proposed change. Okay, so that would further...
Shouldn't we have the word substantive? And that first part of the sentence, shouldn't we also put substantive in front of any?
Well, the customer's proposed change, I don't think we need to say substantive there.
Okay.
Because who knows what that means. I don't know what that would mean, but... okay, I think that makes sense. I just wanted to clarify that contract duration and price, that refers to the provider's change, which would be substantive.
All right. So, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Senator Anderson raises a good point, because if we use the term substantive change on line 36, that is a defined term already, and the defined term includes contract price and contract term. So we would not have to repeat that language. And so on page 11, there could be on the end of line 1, after change, insert a period and delete everything before the on line 2, where we would be repeating an unnecessary reference to contract duration and price.
So Senator Kelly moves that amendment?
So, Mr. Chairman, I want to make clear I'm incorporating in my amendment the inclusion of substantive.
On which line?
On line 36 of page 10, and then the change.
After the word any?
Yes.
Okay.
And then, Mr. Chair, going back to the definition then, so contract duration and price is the same thing as an increase in the charge to the customer under that contract?
Right.
Or an extension of the term of that contract?
Correct.
That's the same thing, you think? Okay, fine. Okay.
Mr. Fuller, do you have that amendment? You do. So do people understand it? We don't need to recite it then? You've got it for the report? Okay.
You want me to continue?
I don't need to.
You guys?
No.
With that, any other discussion? All those in favor of Senator Kelly's motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign, amendment passes. I have one more thought. I think we discussed Article 1, but I don't think we actually ever moved it. Somebody remember differently? Otherwise, I'm going to move. Huh? I'm going to just move the House language, the Senate language. That's the one we're taking, right? Mm-hmm. Move the approval of the Senate language in Article 1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
That's the bill that got us in here.
At the risk of incurring the committee's displeasure, on going back to Senator Kelly's amendment, on page 11, line 5, starting with the provider must maintain recorded or electronic verification of the disclosure. Do we want to put language in there saying something about for the life of the contract? Or are we better off leaving sleeping dogs lie here?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. I'm happy I got distracted a second.
Okay. Line 5 on page 11, the provider must maintain recorded or electronic verification of the disclosure. Do we want to add language there saying for the life of the contract or words to that effect?
I'm Mr. Chair and Representative Hoppe. The only thing I'm wondering is if there's a subsequent contract, if they renew the contract, then which contract's life are you talking about?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Hoppe and Senator Anderson, I think Representative Hoppe has a good point because in on page 10, lines 22 through 23, we do specify that with respect to a verification on that change. So it seems to me we ought to be consistent.
So you want to make...
Sure, I'll move it proposal. On line 6, after the word disclosure, we delete...
What page?
Page 11. Line 6, after the word disclosure, we delete the period and add the words for the duration of the contract period, period.
Okay, this council got that? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion carries. Anything?
Mr. Chairman, we had a lot of discussion of amendments to Article 7. I'm wondering if we actually move to accept Article 7 as amended.
Oh, I think you might then like Article 1. Just did you?
You moved the sunset.
We moved the... Oh yeah, we moved the sunset, and we... I think you're right. Let's just do it for preventive.
And we have various, we had Representative Beard's motions with respect to amendments.
Senator Kelly will move the approval of Article 7 as amended. To be adopted. The Senate moves the approval of the Senate language as amended by Conference Committee for approval. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. That motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, we did pick up Article 8 as well, right?
What was Article 8?
Article 8 was the technical changes to the cable.
You know, I don't... Did we?
Mr.
I don't believe we did.
Mr. Chairman, we adopted the House language.
Oh, we did?
Yep.
Mr. Chair, okay. Did we adopt Article 2?
Yeah, yep. 2 okay. And 3 together.
That's, I knew we did 3. I wasn't
we
sure.
We did do 8.
Did 2?
We did... I remember 3. I didn't remember 2.
Okay.
Okay.
It'll be in there.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, anything else? Members, I think we are done. Do we have to do anything final to approve the conference?
You'll have to.
But we don't have to make any more motions tonight. And approve that? Okay. At this time, we will... I'll make a motion to direct staff to incorporate the changes and prepare a conference report for the members to sign and approve. Is that right, Mr. Fuller?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Did we actually, I know we just talked about this, but did we approve 8?
Mm-hmm.
Did it on Article 8? Okay.
So, and... including Article 8 in this motion. On your discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Staff, prepare the conference.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to prolong the proceedings because we do have a lot done, but you know, I know that the House had significant concerns about Article 4 and that it had challenges in committee and so forth, but I don't want the cable companies leaving here thinking that the debate is over on the issue of how we get more competition in the video business we've had people invite them to be at the table. We encourage them to be participants in those discussions, and that in the same way they lost a vote on the Senate floor in 2005 or other years, they might lose a vote on the House floor. We need to see some efforts to encourage competition in the video business in Minnesota rather than the approach that's been taken up to now.
Well, and Senator Kelly, I would echo that. I will say now on the record as well, we heard it today and our testimony, they will work with the industry to come up with a compromise. We expect from the House position, and I think, Senator Kelly, to echo your terms from the Senate's position, that come next January, we don't want to hear reports that they've just decided to not negotiate, I think is what you're saying, and I would agree with. Folks in the audience, take notice of that. Also in the telco area, we know there's bigger reform deregulation issues that need to be addressed, and take that to heart. We've talked about that in committee. We've talked about it on the House and Senate floor, and as the chair and as a committee member, I think I can speak for our side, all conferees included, that we want serious discussions and suggestions, proposals coming back to us next year. Senator Kelly, I would guess that's some of your consensus too.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with what you said,
including access reform.
With that, I think that's one of the studies that's been approved in your Article 9 as well, correct?
No, Mr. Chairman, we took that out. Too many people had heart. That was in. That
isn't there study language to come up with
extended area
service statewide calling plans? That might happen to enter into the discussion. Any other discussion? Otherwise, this conference committee is adjourned. Thank you, members.
Thank you very much.